Welcome to the High Existence Podcast. This is your host, John Brooks. Today's episode is a scorcher. Very fascinating, very entertaining, and it's conducted by Jordan Bates. He is speaking to Bob Frizzell, so I'm just going to let Jordan tell you more about what's included in today's episode. Jordan?
Bob Frizzell came into my reality in quite a fitting fashion, by synchronicity. I was in a bookstore called Myopic Books in Chicago, perusing the esoteric and occult section when a book caught my eye. It was called Nothing in This Book Is True, But It's Exactly How Things Are. I grabbed the book and began to page through it. In the few days prior, I had discovered and begun reading the work of Drinvalo Melchizedek, a fascinating spiritual teacher who discusses things like unity consciousness, sacred geometry, ancient civilizations, miraculous feats of spiritual masters, and Merkaba energy fields. Paging through Nothing in This Book Is True, I was serendipitously surprised and delighted to find mention of Drinvalo Melchizedek. I realized the book extensively discussed Drinvalo's teaching and elaborated on the same general constellation of topics. It became clear that it was heavily indicated to purchase this book and read it. I would later learn that the book, originally published some 25 years ago, had become a cult classic and sold 500,000 copies worldwide. I devoured the book in the coming days, greatly enjoying its mind-bending contents. On a whim, I decided to email the author, Bob Frizzell, after discovering his website. I mentioned I'd be interested in interviewing him, and within a couple days he replied, and the rest, as they say, is history. Bob and I sat down digitally and had one of the most far-reaching, cranium-detonating conversations I've ever had. It was a lot of fun. If you're open to radical ideas that will challenge your understanding of history, the origins of humanity, our purpose on this planet, and what we're truly capable of, you won't want to miss this one. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Bob Frizzell. I am here with Bob Frizzell. Bob, welcome to the High Existence Podcast. Happy to have you here.
Happy to be here. Thank you, Jordan.
Yeah, thank you. So for those unfamiliar with you and your work, I wondered if you could just begin by telling us some version of your story. What was your early life like, and when did things shift in the direction of exploring the deeper mysteries of reality?
That's a great question. Well, we can have a lot of fun with that. Yeah. Well, wow. I reached a point in my life after growing up asleep and unconscious. I mean, I didn't know a thing. I really didn't. I mean, I was so locked into five sense reality and thinking that's all there is, and what else is there? But awakenings occurred with me primarily out of necessity, more than anything else. And just to cover that for a moment, in the early 1970s, my great goal in life was to be a professional bowler, and I was. But if you want to be a professional athlete in whatever sport you're in, you've got to be 100% totally, completely motivated to, I mean, it's your life, and you need to be willing to do whatever it takes. So you need to be burning with the fire of purpose or 100% intention. And so I had that. And it has served me well in every area. In fact, for me, I thought, well, because I've got it, doesn't everybody have it? Most people do not have a clue what 100% intention or burning desire really is. For most people, it's, well, I'll do it as long as it doesn't get too tough or too bad. Well, that's when you need to roll up your sleeves and get to work. I mean, come on. You know, it's like, yes, it's challenging, you bet, and you will be challenged. But there's nothing like successfully climbing that mountain and realizing that you there's more to climb, there's more to go. You're just getting started. So the reason I lay down this burning desire was because when we tie in the creation out of absolute necessity part, it'll begin to make sense. As a direct result of my bowling in an early 1970s tournament, I was traveling around the country, different tournament every week on the professional tour, and in one tournament, the approaches were really, really sticky. I don't know if you know anything about bowling or not, but sticky approaches are not good. It's kind of hard to, make the shot that you want. Yet we were in a tournament, and so I had to find a way to battle through it. But what happened is that I hurt my back. And like a dummy, I just tried to ignore it and play through it. Even though I did have to cancel out of, a number of tournaments. I mean, I knew I was gone, but I just did my best to try and fight through it. And all that did was make it worse. So I turned an injury that perhaps could have been treated into something that was, something that I won't, it left me with a life that it was hardly worth living. It's like I was crippled, man. That's not much fun. You're a young guy and you were able to do all this, that, and whatever, and now you can't do much of anything. So I committed to finding a way to heal myself. There were only three options. The first option was, I would go to chiropractors, and they helped a lot, at least in the beginning. But diminishing returns quickly set in. And so, I could somehow get straightened out a little bit with a chiropractor, but 5 minutes later, there we go again, It was kind of like that. I ruled out doctors. I had heard of too many horror stories of back surgery and people wishing, too late now, sorry, but you can't go and undo that. So it left only one option, and that was to find a way to heal myself. And when I say that I was asleep and unconscious, I'm not kidding, Jordan. I mean, that's probably an understatement. So I didn't know any of the stuff, nothing that I know now. I only knew that I was totally committed to finding a way to heal myself. And there's the burning desire, which I thought, well, doesn't everybody have that? But out of that, the way did begin to reveal itself. The way will reveal itself if you're totally committed to it, no matter where you're starting from. And it did. And so out of that, to make a long story short, even though it took more like, close to, 15 years to really begin to get some healing, when I discovered that everything is just energy, your body, my body, it's all just energy. And when you learn to deal with energy and to harmonize the distortion, then, in the base state in your body, then the body's going to respond. And so I discovered that, and I'm really kind of glad I did, because it did produce a 100% healing, even though it took many, many years. But in that journey, in that quest, I began to learn a whole lot of things, not only about healing myself, but also the fact that everything is a function of consciousness. And so if you want to learn how to heal yourself, you're going to have to wake up and discover yourself as a conscious being, a spiritual being, having a human experience, rather than, asleep and unconscious like I was. And in the course of waking up, I began to realize that, holy cow, there's just a number of veils here that, when you're locked into the five sense reality, you don't know, and you don't know that you don't know that they're there. That's just reality. But once you start waking up a bit, you start seeing, holy cow, what if I lift this one up a little bit? What am I going to see? Well, I begin to realize that we've been lied to. You and I have been lied to in just unimaginable ways across the board. We could do a whole day on that, But I'll leave that to other people. Other people have done a pretty good. David Icke has done a real good job on that one. So my burning desire just led me to wanting to find out what's the truth here. What's really going on? I don't want to be lied to anymore. I don't want to buy into this nonsense anymore. And so that just opened up a number of doorways. Mm. Well, now to cut back to sort of get back perhaps a bit more on track here. That's a great question you asked. In the early 1990s, actually it was about 1987, 88, I committed myself to becoming a full-time teacher of breathwork. And so it's what I use to heal myself. And I've used it very successfully as a teacher for many, many other people too, to, you know, create emotional resolution, to heal traumas and injuries and all sorts of different things. And so one day in October of 1992, I got a call from a guy who was calling to check me out. He wanted to come for a breathwork session. But he was very unlike most people who call me in that he was extremely resistant and skeptical. I mean, he didn't, I couldn't figure out, why is this guy calling me? What's going on here? You know, usually it's just people who are really wanting to join the program. This guy was 180 degrees opposite, but he came. And he brought all his doubts. And as he say, he brought his dark cloud with him too. He certainly did. But in that very first session, he had an eye-opening experience. I mean, he had an experience that was well beyond anything that he was expecting. And so that happened during the session. And so all of a sudden, I gained some instant credibility. And now we could talk. And I found out very quickly that he owned a publishing company. And no, I was not campaigning to write a book, not at all. It was the least of my, you know, never even occurred to me to write a book. You've got to be kidding. I'm not an author. So, but what interested me is that it was his publishing company that published a book by Richard Hoagland called The Monuments on Mars. And that coincided exactly, or very closely, fit really nice with what I was learning about Mars, and as just one segment of all the awakening that was going on with me. And so I continued to pump him for knowledge about, you know, the monuments on Mars and what Hoagland knows and what he knew about it and like that. And I willingly shared all that I was learning too. And so what this led to was his calling me one day, I don't know, it was probably maybe a couple weeks or a month or so after we first met. And by the way, he came for 30 consecutive weeks doing breathwork sessions with me. So we got to know each other real well. And he asked me in this phone conversation, would you be interested in writing a book? Now, my initial response was, no, I'm not an author. But I remembered that 4 years prior, I had made an internal decision. In 1988, a client came to me and did a number of sessions with me and revealed to me after, I don't know, 7-8 sessions that she was an author, that she was keeping a detailed diary of our sessions, and she wanted me to co-author a book with her. When she told me that she didn't have a publisher, that in fact we would be submitting a book proposal and use that to try and find a publisher, I just used that as an excuse. Truth is, I didn't think I had anything to say. But I decided internally, I didn't tell her, I made an internal decision that the only way I would ever write a book is if a publisher comes to me and asks me. And I thought I was safe, right? 4 years later, that's exactly what happened. So, you know, now I'm an author. And 15 months later, Nothing in This Book Is True came out. And it surprised everyone by catching fire almost instantly. You know, 2-3 months down the road, I was an instant celebrity, getting on a plane, going somewhere every week, and, you know, like that. It has subsequently sold 500,000 copies. It's been printed in at least 25 languages. So the word has gotten out there. And in this brand new edition, this guy right here, this is really a new book, but I used the opportunity to call it the 25th anniversary edition of Nothing in This Book Is True, because it is. It is 25 years exactly, but also because it gave me a chance not only to write a new book, but to enhance what I had already written and to update it and to make it into, for me, a much more presentable, much more coherent reading than the earlier editions had been, even though they did extremely well. So how's that for a long-winded answer to your question?
That's a wonderfully long-winded answer. And yes, I really, it is. I found that
I found all of that highly fascinating. You've lived quite an extraordinary life, I would say. And it was synchronistically, it was about a month ago that I came upon your work simply wandering through a bookstore spontaneously in Chicago. I happened to find an earlier version, one of the earliest versions.
Yeah, why don't you show it?
The third edition, which is more of a relic from history now, but this copy I hold near and dear to my heart because I plucked it off the shelf and I saw this title, "Nothing in This Book Is True, But It's Exactly How Things Are," and it immediately just caught my eye and I thought, I got to read this book. And then I read it and it was just enchanting and illuminating in a variety of ways, extremely mind-bending and thought-provoking. And I wanted to ask if you could just give an explanation of the title of the book, which is such a striking and memorable sentence.
Well, for me, there's no great mystery behind it. The publisher, whose name is Richard, one day, while I was, I don't remember, but certainly had gotten to the point to where I had agreed to write the book, and perhaps was in the early stages of writing it, I don't remember exactly. But one day he brought his daughter, who at the time was 19 years old, to come and visit with me. And I think that his daughter, Miranda, was probably his chief advisor. So I was introduced to Miranda, and she just asked me a bunch of questions, and I just told her. I didn't sugarcoat anything. I just said, here, this is what I think, this is what I've learned. And we went on for about a half an hour. And then they left. And then Richard later relayed to me the conversation that he says took place on their way to the car. And he asked her, "Well, what did you think?" Now he said, "I don't know if this is the exact response, but Richard said it was." He said that she said, "Well, nothing he said was true, but it is exactly how things are." And so, you know, I kind of suspect that Richard might have enhanced that conversation just a little bit because he wanted to push this as the title for me. And I go, well, I think that would make a great title. Yeah. And so it's really no more complicated than that, you know.
That's quite a precocious 19-year-old to make that observation, I would say. Yeah, right. It immediately made me think of the Korzybski's quip that the map is not the territory, and it made me think, maybe he's saying that, you know, this is one map, but naturally no map can ever contain the infinite territory of reality, and yet this map is nonetheless a highly accurate map. So that was my immediate assumption.
Well, it certainly has proven to be a useful title of a book, and it worked for you. You pick it, nothing. I got to read this book, you know. Many, many people have said the same thing, yeah. Mm. Yeah. So it's been a really good title. I mean, that was the other thing. This really is a new book. It has 10 completely new chapters and major, major revisions and additions in just about every other chapter. But I just had to keep the title. I mean, it's like, come on, you know.
Absolutely.
And it's doing
iconic.
Really, really well, so.
Yeah, it's an iconic title for sure. It's beautiful. Probably going to have to name a rap song that sometime or something to, you know, pay an homage to that title or something like that.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if you've heard of the band or not, Tool or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, they got a hold of the book, and they in their website listed it as preferred reading. And so all of a sudden, I mean, that was one of the many things that happened that caused this book to really take off. Hmm. But then all of a sudden I get all these Tool fans, not only reading my book, but coming to my workshops too. Hmm. And to cap it off, in August of 2003, I was invited to be primary speaker at one of their conventions, not the band, but the Tool fans of the band. So, I mean, the band did not show up, but there were plenty of Tool fans there, and we had a great time. So who's the drummer, Danny Carey? Yeah, he and some of the songs that Tool did, one is called 46 plus 2, I believe. There's no other way that he would have known about that or heard about that except from my book. And that is the the number of chromosomes for Christ consciousness. Hmm. And I think they wrote a song about the Merkaba too. And all that stuff came straight out of my book. So thanks, Tool. I'm grateful.
Yeah. You know? Thanks, Tool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So before we go further, I wanted to ask kind of a meta question about your work and about esotericism and esoteric study in general, because I think our audience spans a pretty broad range of people who are deeper into this type of subject matter and people who are more in the kind of skeptical, more more within the mainstream scientific paradigm. And so I wanted to ask, you write about a lot of highly esoteric subject matter, such as extraterrestrials and transdimensional entities, and God, Atlantis, sacred geometry, energy fields, parallel dimensions, the Illuminati, ascended masters, and so on. I find all this information highly fascinating. And I just wanted to ask, for those who are more skeptical about this type of information, what do you think is the best access point to begin investigating and absorbing this type of esoteric information in a way that allows for some degree of experiential verification or evidence-based verification of this information to kind of like maybe a master key to kind of begin to unlock this labyrinth?
Yeah, well, that's not an easy question to answer. If we go back to as like the statement I made earlier, the degree to which you and I have been lied to, it's just clear. It's just across the board. We've been lied to about virtually everything. And so how do you start to cut through that? Well, for me, it was just a total burning desire to want to find out, to want to be able to lift the veils enough to get a grip on what's going on, or at least a better idea. I was just sick and tired of the lies. Still am. Don't like them any more now than I did then. But, you know, at least I'm have a vision that's a bit clearer than most folks out there. To me, Jordan, everything is a function of consciousness. I don't really care about trying to prove any of this stuff to anybody. It either resonates with you or it doesn't. And if it does, well, it's going to open up a whole new adventurous life for you. And if it doesn't, that's okay too. You know, when the time is right, what's the saying? When the time is right, the teacher will appear. When the time is right, this book will appear to you in some used bookshop, or it'll just jump out to you. Or if the time wasn't right, you wouldn't even have been in that bookshop. You wouldn't even have seen the book. And so to me, timing is of critical importance with regard to everything. And so there is an enormous infusion of higher vibratory energy that's impacting the planet here, and it's affecting everybody on the planet whether they know it or not. It is stirring things up, and so it's accelerating. Excuse me, you're not supposed to clear your throat without muting your switch. I'm sorry. That's you can okay. But you can edit that, I'm sure. Uh-huh. Or not, it don't matter. Yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so kind of lost
higher,
where I was.
Higher
there,
vibratory but, energy.
Oh yeah,
influx.
Right. And so what it's doing is dramatically speeding things up, and so more and more people are waking up to you know, wanting to lift the veil, wanting to know what's going on, being tired of the lies. You know, for me, it happened 30 years ago, but I'm really glad to see that there's an enormous awakening that's going on today. And so I just leave it at that. When the timing is right, this sort of information will appear to people. And I mean, the enormous amount of feedback I've got from this book in this 25 years is just, in, you know, it's overwhelming. I mean, how it's impacted people's lives, and how in a totally positive way. So I'm
beautiful.
Glad.
Yeah. I wonder if some of the more experiential based practices, such as the breath work you talked about, or meditation, or working with plant medicines, may be one of the best access points for people who are curious about this world and want to have a non-ordinary experience that begins to suggest to them that there's much more outside the kind of cultural blinders than they've been led to believe.
Yeah. And furthermore, it all begins with going within, learning how to discover that it's all within you. It's all contained within you. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. We, our source energy moves right through us. Well, I'll tell you, the breath work that I teach, I call breath alchemy, has opened up many, many people to realities that, you know, talk about not knowing and not knowing that you don't know were there. It's a mind blower. You know, just as psychedelics are and have been a door opener for many people. Well, breath work is a psychedelic, only you don't have to pop any pill. It's like you discover it's all contained within you. You don't need the mushrooms or the LSD or the ayahuasca or any of that stuff to begin to get a grip on experiential grip on your true nature. So, meditation, yeah, that's good stuff too. And I teach all of that, yeah.
One more kind of closely related question here is, I just wanted to note that my biggest personal struggle with this type of information and other esoteric or channeled information are the things that I feel unable to experientially verify. There's a lot of stuff that I can experientially verify through meditation and through mystical reveries that I can go into with psychedelics and stuff. But for the rest, it seems there's a lot of stuff, such as stuff about ancient history and things like this, that I simply have to see, as you said, if it intuitively resonates with me. And I'm increasingly finding that my intuitive compass is a sharper and sharper instrument for indicating, you know, truth from falsehood. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, we're in a time where there's so much misleading information out there in the world and on the internet. And I'm left wishing I had more tools to verify a lot of this information. I'm curious how you navigated that for yourself, or how you continue to navigate that. If there's any pointers at all you could give.
Well, I was already pretty well along the path when the ancient history things started coming to me. And so perhaps more than anything, it just intuitively resonated. Mm-hmm. And then the more I looked into it, the more I researched it, the more I began to realize that there really is something here. In the new book, I've added some more, ways of, you might say, verifying this, or at least making the claims a lot more solid. When I make the point of a man by the name of Karl Monk, let me preface this a little bit. In the ancient history chapter, the Earth history chapter in my book, I talk about how the Great Pyramid was built about 13,200 years ago with the aid of three ascended masters primarily, Thoth, Ra, and Ar-Aragog. People who are ascended masters, meaning they're still alive today, and they live on a different aspect of the earth. They're on a much higher dimensional level, higher overtones of the sixth dimension, but they can come down here and grab a body anytime they want. And in fact, for 52,000 years, Thoth did that. Most of them don't, but a few of them do. People have perhaps heard of Saint Germain. He's another one who's been in a third dimensional body for a lot of the time. Anyway, in the book, I state how they built the Great Pyramid 13,200 years ago. It was created on the fourth dimensional level. And it basically, it was just totally a function of their consciousness, six dimensional beings. Whatever you think, you could say is the instantly manifested reality. So they built the Great Pyramid in perfect precision from the top down. And, you know, all the rest of this that sounds really unbelievable to the uneducated person. Yet, what's even more unbelievable is the official version of how it was done. Impossible. I mean, we cannot create a structure like to even remotely compare to the Great Pyramid today. The mathematical perfect precision of that thing, there's no way. We don't have the technology to do that. And to be able to lift 400-ton blocks 450 feet into the air, yeah, slaves and ramps and ropes, right, I believe that, don't you? You know, so, you know, the official version doesn't add up. And so, you know, you start looking elsewhere for what it might be that really happened here. Well, there's a, and so I go on to make the point that they then constructed 83,000 what we call sacred sites, or what spiritual people would call sacred sites, at least, you know, the Great Pyramid being the very first one. They were all first created on the fourth dimensional level. And then over the course of 13,000 years, people, you might say, in the third dimensional level just sort of intuitively got the hit. Oh, I need to build a church here or a temple here or a pyramid there, like Chichen Itza, just to give one concrete example. Perfectly aligning on the third dimensional level what already had been created on the fourth dimensional level. Well, what these guys were doing was a process called geomancy, which is the process of consciously configuring or manipulating, you might say, the energy on the surface of the earth in such a way that it also influences the energy above the earth. What they were doing was synthetically creating a grid that will allow us to go into the next level of awareness. There's just so much stuff here that, you know, I'm sorry, I can't explain everything. You're just going to have to read the book, listeners, if you want to get it all. But anyway, I just left it there in the version that you've got. But in the new version here, I talk about this man named Carl Monk, who has proven, he's taken 250 of these sacred sites, and he has shown conclusively that they all link back to this single spot in Egypt, meaning the Great Pyramid, which is ground zero for the entire system. The latitude and the longitude is encoded on every one of these sacred sites that he's observed, and they all link directly back to the Great Pyramid in Giza. Now, come on, even if it was only 10, that is beyond the realm of coincidence. 250 sites out of 83,000, yeah, I still got a few more to go. But how can, you know, I mean, to me, that's proof. That is proof of what we're talking about here. And so there's a whole, speaking of lifting the veil, what you and I think passes for reality, forget it, man. It's got nothing to do with what's really going on. Mm. And so why would our interpretation of history be any different? Mm. Why would the lie stop there? And most people don't know anyway. So, you know, it all began in 3800 BC in Sumer, and before that, there was nothing but hairy barbarians. Well, yeah, I believe that, don't you? You know, in the book, I make the point that this Earth is a star seed. It has a 500 million year history where advanced life forms have come from all over the cosmos, combined with other life forms, create new life forms, and then they leave. And when they leave, they don't leave a trace behind them. They're just gone, so you wouldn't know they were here. And it's probably happening on a different dimensional level anyway. And that's how we were created 200 and some thousand years ago. And so all the details, and I got a lot of that from Zachariah Sitchin and the rest of it from Drunvalo Melchizedek and his telling about how his interactions with Thoth, and Thoth gave him this information. You put the two together. And you, maybe it's accurate, maybe it's not, but it's pretty darn good. It makes a great story. And it certainly is a better story than it all began 3800 BC in Sumerian. Before that, there was nothing but hairy barbarians. I mean, come on, folks. It's time to wake up.
Well said. Well said. I find that synchronicities also seem to be little signals that can help you start to see that more of this information is accurate, more and more of it is accurate. For instance, I recently have come into the awareness that I might be going to Bosnia sometime soon because a friend has a home there. And then I just so happened to learn after that a large pyramid has been discovered in Bosnia, and that it's one of the largest pyramids on the earth. And it just so happens that it's in close proximity to where I may be visiting, and you know, if I go to Bosnia, I'm sure as hell gonna go visit that pyramid. And so just seemed like a little wink, you know, a little wink from the universe. And and finding your book synchronistically, right, as fascinatingly, I had actually just come into the awareness of Drunvalo's work through my friend who I was with in that Chicago bookstore. He had one of Drunvalo's Flower of Life books. And then we go to that bookstore. I had just started reading that. And then we go to that bookstore and we just happened to find your book there. And things like that suggest a level of, you know, a divinely ordered tapestry and just levels of order going on beyond our common conception that gradually have really unlocked things for me. So
sure. And when you're ready for it, these sort of things will begin to appear in your life. If you're not ready, even if they do appear, you're just going to ignore them. But obviously you were ready. And so here you go.
Yeah.
Welcome aboard. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I was going to ask, I'd love to hear any stories of the most profound, mystical, transcendent, numinous, or transformational experiences you've ever had. What happened to you and how did that change your life? Any particular experiences?
Yeah, well, there's been a number of them. And I've got a little saying, well, actually it's plastered up to a bulletin board I have. And what it says is, I expect a miracle. And let me preface that by suggesting that what's a miracle to one person is just commonplace stuff to another person. And the thing is that as you learn to expand your horizons and learn that you're creating your reality and learning that you can expand your horizons to the points where you can begin to create from the field of all possibility. Whereas before, you know, you were a powerless victim who was convinced that the power and the authority lies outside of yourself. So just in the area of healing, for example, well, look at our culture, how we've given our power away to the medical profession to the point to where most people are totally, absolutely dependent upon it. Now, what is allopathic medicine? Well, what it is it's taken every true form of healing, thrown it out the window, and left you with two options. Number one, cut out what's not working, not even beginning to consider the body as a whole, as a system of energy. And number two, hey, we got big pharma. Well, by golly, we'll give you, you know, oh, don't worry about the side effects. That's only for the other guy. That's not going to happen to you. You know, So how well does the medical profession work? Well, yeah. And so on the other hand, once you begin to realize that your body is just energy and that the answer to all of these things are contained within you, then the whole new world opens up to you. And so just as a little preface, in August of 1980, I was still nursing a back injury that, well, I was not in real good shape. But in August of 1980, I had an experience that was rather amazing, to say the least, when a cat of mine, little orange tabby, not a little orange tabby, but my good buddy named Freddy, all of a sudden, really with no warning, became paralyzed in his two rear legs, couldn't move them at all. He didn't appear to be in any pain, and he could move by just kind of pawing himself forward, and he was just being Freddy, just like, it's no big deal, you know. He wasn't howling or he was just being very gentle and okay throughout all of it. I was the one who was freaking out. I was going, geez, poor Freddy, you know. I'd like to try and help you. Took him to the vet, had no clue, and just didn't know what I could do. But after a few days of that, sitting back in on my balcony on my patio with him in the early evening, all of a sudden I had a spontaneous internal thing that happened with me. And it just began innocently enough with the thought or the belief, or I don't even know what you would call it, that what's going on here? There's no reason why you can't be totally healed. And it just spontaneously grew very, very quickly. It was something inside of me. I wasn't doing it. It got to the point very quickly to where I knew and felt throughout all of my senses with total, complete, and absolute certainty that there is absolutely no reason why Freddie cannot and will not be totally and completely healed. In that moment, he got up and walked around like nothing had ever happened. Never, ever again to be troubled with that rear paralysis. So, and the interesting thing is that it seemed totally normal to me at the time, like no big deal at all. Just, you know, it just seemed so natural and so normal. But, you know, and I was overjoyed. I was very grateful to say the least. But that was only the beginning, because a couple weeks later, he came back from his daily adventures, wherever cats go, you know, checking out their territory every day. And he had one island closed. It's like this. It didn't seem like any big deal. I didn't think anything of it. It remained that way for a couple of weeks. But after a couple of weeks or so, it opened. And what I saw was that was not an eyeball. That was just a piece of dead flesh. I mean, it just looked awful, totally deformed, just flat out awful. Well, again, I took him to the vet. I didn't know what to do, what else to do. And the vet, what can he do? Really, he wished me luck and said, you better get back here in a couple days or real quick, because we're going to have to surgically remove that eyeball. And that didn't sound like a real good idea to me, but I didn't see any other option. But we went home, Freddie and I, and the same thing happened again, sitting again out on the same deck in the early evening. And that spontaneous vision quickly got to the point, quickly. I mean, it just happened outside of time. Within time, maybe within a minute or two or three at the most. But I quickly got to the point to where I saw and I knew and I felt throughout all of my senses with total certainty that he would instantly and be completely healed. And right before my very eyes, his eye instantly healed. It went from this totally ugly piece of dead flesh to a perfectly normal looking eyeball, just like that. Never ever again to be troubled by paralysis or a deformed eyeball. So I thought that was pretty good. Yeah. And I wrote about that in the new book, but I chickened out and I'm going to tell you what happened. I'm going to tell you what really happened. I did chicken out and I just said in the new book, well, I'm still to this day don't really know I know exactly what happened. What had happened is that in August of 1980, I had just returned from spending the summer in Europe. Me with a bum back, and I'm spending the summer, not a very, but I did it because I was in training to become a teacher of breathwork, and I figured that it was important. You know, I got, again, the intuitive, you've got to do this, you've got to go there. And so I learned to listen to my inner self or higher self or whatever you want to call it, and to not question it. And somehow I made it through, you know, without seeing a chiropractor or whatever. And when I got back, this is what had all happened. But during the time in Europe, and this is really going to go out on the limb, and this is why I didn't put it in the book, but there is really, he's on the level of ascended masters, if you want to believe in that. There's about 7,000 or 8,000 of them, and I don't question it. I know it's true. But for the doubters, I'm going to give you something to doubt here. There is an entity that has been referenced in a book by a man by the name of Paramahansa Yogananda in his book, mm-hmm. Autobiography of a Yogi. Have you ever heard of that book?
Yeah, I've heard of that book.
Okay, well, in that book, he has a chapter called Babaji, the Yogi Christ of India. And in that chapter, he tells of some of the miracles that Babaji has created that, you know, to the average person, it would just be impossible. So either you accept that or you don't. Well, for me, I was just open to it as a possibility. I didn't go, yes, I wildly believe this. I didn't go, no, because I realized that if I did, I would totally shut off. What if it's real? If I say no, then I'm cutting myself off from the possibility. So I stayed open. And what I discovered is that in that European trip, there were a number of devotees of Babaji that I ran into. And they, I would sit and ask them, well, what do you know about Babaji? And they would tell me really some rather amazing stories. And so I just go there and, yeah, okay, well, that's, thank you for sharing. And just remained open to it. Well, for me personally, trying to navigate my way through Europe on a bum back was not easy. When we got to Stockholm, Sweden, I was really, you know, I was just stressed out and had gone about as far as I could. I didn't know if I could make it another day. And all of a sudden, something happened that had never, ever happened before, and I got an inner voice. I'd never had that before. It was very clear communication telling me very simply that in spite of all the outward turmoil, everything is okay. You are okay. You're going to be okay throughout all of this. And I intuitively knew it was Babaji. I mean, I couldn't prove it, but I didn't have any interest in did I hear that? Yes, I did hear that voice. It was real. Mm-hmm. And it kept with me, and it saw me through the remainder of this trip. Well, what happened when I got back home in California in August of 1980 in my adventures with Freddie was the Babaji saga was just continuing. And I knew that. I knew that with certainty. And I got a total confirmation from it that it's undeniable. You know, no psychedelic would ever give me the confirmation that I got from it. So I knew that was what was behind this. But the thing is, Jordan, is that it also took me a good 12 years or more to even begin to understand what had really happened. Because I, for 12 years, gave my power away to Babaji. Well, it was just Babaji. And I didn't realize that another way of looking at it was that it was my higher self, my connection to source energy coming through me in the form of Babaji. And it took me many years to progress enough to get to the point to where I began to realize that. And that's when I first began to really heal too, by the way. So maybe I should have put that in the new book. Maybe I shouldn't. I didn't. Mm. That's that.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story. And I think you also mentioned that you went to Europe with barely a penny to your name and just kind of trusted spirit as well, and it guided you through that escapade.
All right. That's true. Yeah. I had enough money for a one-way ticket to London. One way. How are you going to get back? Hitchhike?
Trust the universe.
I had maybe, I don't know, less than $100 to spend. So, yeah, it was very much a trust the universe type thing, and it all worked out. I had to learn real, real quick and then kind of take what I was learning one day and turn around and teach it the next day and hope that people would pay me something. That's how I got through.
That reminds me of Terence McKenna saying, nature loves courage. You make the commitment and nature will respond to that commitment by removing impossible obstacles. It seems like leaps of that nature become very important as you progress on this path for kind of demonstrating your pure intent and your burning desire and your trust to reality, and you take the leap and then reality takes a leap toward you.
Exactly. Well said. And so if you've got that, you've got to have a burning desire in order to be that audacious, to step that far out onto the limb. And what I will say is that had I not done that, had I not agreed to go to Europe in the summer of 1980, you and I would not be having this conversation. Nothing would have happened. But because I did, you could say that I demonstrated to the universe that, hey, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. And you don't think so? Watch this. No, I didn't put it out that way. But, you know, to me, that in total intention was just, for me, just a natural thing. And I'll tell you what happened. It was I was studying with Leonard Orr, and he was one of the prime instigators, and he was really the founder of breathwork. He really was, and so he was prepping us all to go spend the summer in Europe with him to train and travel from different countries. The whole purpose was to learn how to become a breathwork teacher. And I came up to Leonard one day and I said, Leonard, I just don't want to go to Europe. I don't have the money or any of the rest of that. He said nothing, but he just looked me straight in the eye with a smile on his face. And he says, Bob, come to Europe. In that moment, everything shifted. And I knew I was going to Europe. Didn't know I was going to get there any of the rest of it, but I knew I was going to Europe. So it happened just like that. Just on a dime.
Another wink from the universe that I want to just note right now is that three of my next four questions were literally going to be asking about Babaji, then asking about Freddie's eye infection, your cat Freddie, and then asking about Leonard Orr. So you just basically psychically intuited three of my next four questions and began to talk about them, which that type of thing as well just seems to happen more and more frequently to me, and just repeatedly experientially verifies that consciousness does not emerge from physicality, but rather consciousness is more fundamental and the deep non-local interconnection of all of it.
And so I mean, that's really well said, Jordan. And to go back to your earlier question about, you know, how do you deal with skeptics? Well, I don't. I mean, I don't even attempt to. It's really interesting getting interviewed on by skeptics, and it's happened a couple of times. You know, it's usually AM radio stations that, you know, for one reason or another, and they've never read your book, by the way. Oh, don't ever bother to read the book. Oh no, can't go there. So, you know, it's interesting, But so you see here again, you're just demonstrating how when the time is right, these quote unquote coincidences, they just happen. And so it's like that. And when you're ready for it, then you're ready. And when you're not, you're not. And so it's fine to be a skeptic. I've got a lot of skeptic in me too. It may not seem that way or sound that way, but I don't just blindly believe everything I'm told. There is so many lies and so much disinformation out there that you got to be nuts to just blindly believe everything you're told. I mean, come on, you know?
Right.
So you have to be a bit discerning. But the greatest discerner is your internal bell. You know, I got a pretty good, a pretty active BS meter, and it lets me know. And what it is my intuitive connection to source. And plus, having been around the block for 30 years and exploring this stuff, and it's pretty darn accurate, I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. At least it works for me.
Yeah,
trying to convince anybody else, you know. You want to know the truth, you got to start to look within, and you will be guided when you're ready.
Yeah, I've also in my adult life had a highly skeptical mind for a lot of years, and really wanted evidence for things and stuff, and the fact that that's gradually through the process of just undeniable repeated experiential verifications through synchronicity and visionary experiences and psychedelic experiences, that it's just gradually been communicated again and again, no, you need to dethrone rationality as the dictator of your consciousness. Intuition is connected to the infinite intelligence of all that is, and rationality is more of a useful tool, a kind of useful scalpel, but intuition is king, basically. And it's just the fact that I came from that place of more hard-nosed skepticism, I think, is a testament to the power of these experiences and of this information once you begin to be guided into these waters. So yeah, it's cool.
Well, there's a whole lot more going on to this reality than just what our five senses are telling us. I have a chapter in the book called Dimensions, as you know, Dimensions, showing, detailing how dimensional worlds, and there's almost an infinite number of them, all sharing the same space as this one, and the difference between one and the next one is wavelength. And that as you move up, the vibratory rate quickens dramatically, the wavelength is shorter, and it's a very awake world relative to our third dimensional denseness here, where still, you know, not too many of the veils have been lifted. But so there's that. And there's just so much more. I mean, there's just
Yeah. Yeah, a remarkable amount. I wanted to read just a short passage from your chapter on Babaji that I found really striking. You wrote that, I was also struck by a quote from Babaji, "If you come to me with doubts, I will give you every reason to be doubtful. If you come to me with love, I will show you more than you have ever known." I knew it was important to remain open to the possibility that Babaji was all that everyone said he was. I knew that if I closed down to that possibility, my experience would only be consistent with my doubts. So you kind of paraphrased that earlier, but I wondered, that passage really struck me. I wondered if you had any additional thoughts on that, or any additional thoughts on how we create our own realities through our beliefs, limiting or unlimited beliefs.
Well, that's where I go into in the new book into great detail. 10 completely new chapters, and so in the new book, what I do is, yes, I do detail the what I like to call the enormous infusion of higher dimensional energy, higher vibratory energy that's coming down here, and impacting everyone and everything on this planet. So there's the planetary transformation, and very, very closely associated with that is the personal transformation that you and I must make individually and collectively if the planet is to reach critical mass, so that we can catch the ride and become lit from within and descend as a planet into the higher dimensional levels. And that really is what's going on. For the skeptic, and I don't care what it sounds like really, but it is what's going on and how long it will take. But this planet is very much, very much in the midst of a global transformation the planet's waking up and people are waking up. And the more we do wake up and catch the ride, so to speak, the more we contribute to and create the critical mass that's necessary to really propel the planet into the next level. And what I mean by critical mass, perhaps the most popular reference to it is the whole thing about the 100th monkey theory. I don't know if you've heard about that or not, but it's... What very briefly the 100th monkey theory is that it was back in the 1950s when a team of scientists, allegedly at least, they say that they noticed a bunch of monkeys on some of the islands off the coast of Japan who were eating sweet potatoes. I guess the scientists planted the sweet potatoes. And then one youngster, not one of the adults, but one of the youngsters one day noticed that, you know, the sweet potato would taste a whole lot better if you washed the sand off first. And so this smart young monkey started doing that and showed another monkey and another monkey until critical mass was reached. And at a certain point, the very next day, you might say, all the monkeys on the island were washing their sweet potatoes. Critical mass was the igniter. But to make it even more interesting, what they noticed also was that the monkeys on the nearby islands, who had no direct contact at all with the monkeys on this island, they all of a sudden started washing their sweet potatoes too. So that's the idea of critical mass. And the people of TM have done some scientific research with, of course, they're promoting TM. I can't blame them. But they have shown that this whole idea of critical mass or rippling effect, if you will, is real. And it's real because everything is energy. And so you and I are vibrating at a certain particular frequency, at a certain particular wavelength. Now, if you and I are stuck in the mud with our fears and our doubts and our unresolved emotional trauma, then you and I are vibrating at a very dense rate. And life is bad and it sucks and I can't understand why everybody is doing these terrible things to me and all that. But yet, as you raise your vibratory rate by learning how to integrate your emotion to move through these, you know, incomplete traumas from the past, from early childhood and like that and whatever, as you learn to raise your vibratory rate, then obviously, you know, the vibratory rate of gratitude and of love and appreciation is much, much higher than that of hate and greed and I'll get even with you and like that. I mean, it's a pretty obvious difference. And so, you know, a planet that's vibrating at I'll get even with you if it's the last thing I do is not a very pleasant place in which to live. But the creation of the critical mass is the creation of people who are vibrating and living the reality that you and I are intimately connected, and we're intimately connected to our biosphere. And so if we harm anyone or anything on this planet, we're really just doing damage to ourselves. And this standing apart from and conquering and trying to control nature and you know, I mean, look at what it's led to. We've almost destroyed our planet. So, you know, something has got to give here. Mm. And it is. This critical mass is being created. So I'm not a pessimist at all. I have a very optimistic vision of this, the future of this planet.
I do as well. Well said. And the question I wanted to ask about Leonard Orr relates to humans having capacities far beyond what we commonly realize. You noted in the book that Leonard Orr traveled to India in the 1970s and met Babaji, and then in the years to follow met 7 or 8 individuals in India who were at least 300 years old. And I found this astonishing, and it radically challenges our conception of what's possible as a human being. I wonder if you could tell us more about this and why you think this is possible. And
sure. Well, in the new book, I make the point of the Bible is really, and I'm not a student of the Bible, but one of my clients and a good friend who's done many breathwork sessions with me, well, it turns out that he is a student of the Bible. And so I asked him about these things. And so what I came to realize is that my suspicion was true, that the Bible really is the story of how, even though man was initially created to live forever, to be immortal, the body was initially created to live forever, not to decay and die, and you know, like it does, and that the Bible is really the story of how immortality was lost, because we started missing the mark. And a sin is an archery term meaning you miss the mark. That's all it is. That's all it means. And so by missing the mark, by sinning, if you will, we got disconnected from our intimate connection to all that is and started living in a separate way. We became basically, and I just really emphasize this point in the new book, of how we have become our minds. There was a time, you go way back in the day, when we were in unity. And when you are unity, you perceive wholeness. You don't live separation. You're not looking out at a world that you're separate from and apart from. That's not you. No, you realize your intimate connection to all that is. And so when you're unity-based, you are heart-based. And so the heart perceives unity. The heart knows oneness. When we fell 13,000 years ago, with the sinking of Atlantis, we fell many dimensional levels. And in that falling into a dense, dark aspect of the reality, third dimensional reality, we became our minds. We move from our heart, which only knows unity, into our heads, which only knows separation. So the mind is polarized. As you may have noticed, it's in a continual state of judgment, always comparing the reality to some imaginary standard of how it should be, or how this person should be behaving versus how this person is, or how your job should be versus how it is, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the moment you do that, you're setting yourself up for all sorts of chaos. It is the source of all of our problems. And that might not be immediately obvious to first-time listeners here, but the more you hang out with this, the more it becomes absolutely true. And I state the case quite convincingly, I would suggest, in the new book. And so what this very much is, this process of awakening, is the process of moving back from the head, from the polarized mind, into the oneness space of the heart, and to begin to perceive and live wholeness again. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the question was, but that's the answer.
Yeah. It was the question about immortality, and a medicine man told me once that a true shaman is the one who chooses the moment of his own death. And I thought of that in your discussion of immortality, because you end by saying that it's not necessarily about staying in this body forever, or staying in this form forever, because we're meant to continue of evolving and ascending along the upward spiraling path, but it's about consciously choosing when to leave, when to ascend to the next plane, the next stage.
Or staying as long as you wish. Okay, so you're talking about immortality, which is one of the most taboo subjects for just about anybody. Yeah. Boy, you're really out on the limb when you're talking. I hope you know that.
Yeah.
I know. You do know that. Yeah, I mean, we're all programmed to die, and that's the way it is because everybody else is doing it, so that's just the way it is. But what we don't realize, it's all a function of consciousness. And you can debate the thing about living forever or not, but I would point out, in addition to the ascended masters, who are there's about 7 or 8,000 of them, and many of them have been alive for 50,000 or more years and still are alive. But if you want to reference it a bit further, I would suggest you take a look at Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, which you have. And in that book, there is a chapter that clearly describes Yogananda's teacher, Sri Yukteswar, and his resurrection. Well, there's two alternatives to physical death as we know it. One is called resurrection, one is called ascension. With resurrection, you will die, but you do it kind of with your eyes open, and you're able to reform your light body on the other side, and in so doing, either come back and reclaim your third dimensional body, if you wish, or ascend into the higher worlds, which in this case would be the higher overtones of the fourth dimension. But in ascension, you don't die at all. You have just at that point mastered your ability to turn your body into a ball of light and to change conscious wavelengths and to ascend into the higher worlds that way, bringing your body with you. And the door does swing both ways. You can come back if you want, as Thothis and Saint Germain have clearly demonstrated, you know, if you want to believe that. But to take it a step further, there is a set of books. It's a six-volume set now. It's called The Life and Teaching of the Masters of the Far East, written by Baird T. Spaulding. And it was written back the story goes way back to the 1890s, when a team of Western scientists, I think there were 11 of them, not positive about that, but they went to the Himalayas. They were interested in studying the ancient records. And so what they were given access to was these guys who had amazing abilities. I mean, these guys were immortal, the masters of the Far East. And they quickly learned that these guys had the ability, and regularly did, materialize their food out of thin air, any supplies that they would need on their journeys. They had the ability to walk on water, to walk through fire, and to dematerialize their body and turn a journey of, say, 25, 50 miles into an instant trip. And they were demonstrating this stuff regularly to these scientists. Now, these scientists, these Western scholars who were trained not to believe anything unless you could verify it scientifically, obviously they were skeptical at the beginning, but they came away true believers. In fact, so much of them so that three of the party stayed, they vowed to stay with the masters until they could perform the, you might say, the miracles of the masters themselves. So this is all detailed in this six-volume set of books, Life and Teaching of the Masters of the Far East. I don't care whether people believe it or not. That's here again. When the timing is right, the books will appear. If it's not right, you know, it's just more nonsense. Yeah. But you might want to check those books out.
I'll have to look into those books because I've heard about the Cloud Masters of the Far East, and I'm very curious to learn more about these remarkable human beings. And what you're saying reminds me of the story of Babaji in your book, where he walks through a rainstorm with someone and the other person ends up drenched, and they look at Babaji and he's completely dry. And another, I've heard whispers as well of highly advanced shamans or spiritual masters reaching a point where upon choosing to leave this world, they basically just disapparated and just sort of like rainbow traveled or something out of this world. And all that's left behind is like a pile of ash or a pile of dust where they were standing. And yeah, as you say, it's like, I don't really believe or disbelieve this stuff. I find it all extremely inspiring and fascinating, and increasingly it just causes me to feel that keeping an infinite possibility space is the best way to go for me in life, because if I keep my possibility space infinite and I allow myself to be open to the possibility that the most mythologically rumored human capacities are actually real and that I am also a human who could gain those capacities, then I open myself to the infinite possibilities for exploring this realm and creating without limitation within the parameters of this physiological existence on Earth. So,
yeah, well, there you go. That's very well said. And so there's no value in believing it anyway. I mean, you know, replacing one belief system with another means that you're still subservient to your mind. Look, the mind, the polarized mind, was never, ever intended to be the master of our consciousness. It only took over the job because we gave it the job 13,000 years ago. It was always and only intended to be a servant to our true master, which is consciousness itself, to our intimate connection to the whole that moves right through us. There's only one spirit moving through all of one. There's only one creation pattern. That's the whole point of the sacred geometry chapters in the book, to show you that. Because the mind needs to be shown that there is only one spirit, that there is only one creation pattern, that there is only one image. And because it doesn't believe in unity. It sees exact opposite when it looks out there. So it has to be shown. And the only way you can show it is through logical steps. But once you see that, once the mind really sees that, then an integration can begin to happen. You got the corpus callosum separating the two sides, left brain and the right brain. Well, the corpus callosum has a job to try and facilitate communication between the two sides. But there can be no communication when the two sides are not in agreement. I mean, that's just like a bad marriage, you know? Even if you're telling something truthful to your partner, they're not going to hear you. They're not going to hear that because it's going to conflict with their version of, you know the drill. So it's only when the left brain or the mind can be shown unity and it kind of like settles down, well, maybe, okay, then communication can begin to happen. And that opens up a whole new possibility, that is the doorway to the heart now opens itself. So you can begin to move out of the separate state and back into the state of oneness again. Which all higher dimensional levels, this whole thing about polarity, I mean, it doesn't exist on the higher levels. It's only down here where where we think we're separate from and like that. Yeah.
Another one of your books also has an iconic title, You Are a Spiritual Being Having a Human Experience. I wanted to just ask, what exactly led you to that conclusion that we are spiritual beings temporarily occupying physical bodies? And what do you think is the most reliable way for a person to experientially verify that for themselves?
For many people, psychedelics have been a door opener, letting them know that there's other worlds here. There's a whole lot more. But and it certainly was an eye opener for me, too. But the thing is that with a psychedelic, you're going to come back down again. And so now the trick becomes, well, how do you learn how to do that on your own without the aid of the psychedelic? The single greatest teacher in my life has been breathwork. It's shown me internally a reality that, my goodness, it just opens up everything. And so that's really a short answer, but that's the best answer I can give you.
Beautiful.
I don't even remember what your question was. I always forget the questions, but
spiritual being having a human experience.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we're actually through High Existence. We do these retreats called Apotheosis Retreats, where we do breath work and meditation and work with plant medicines and ecstatic dance. And basically all these modalities are geared toward helping people have that initial breakthrough of realizing this, and then also giving them tools that they can then take home to begin to do the work of integrating. Because as you say, the psychedelics will sort of teleport you much farther up the mountain than where you're currently at. But then without the work of integration, you'll drop back down into the same reality you were in before. So integration is arguably the most important aspect of working with psychedelics.
Yeah, because I mean, through integration, and that's what happens with the breath work. Integration is what it does is it creates a gap between your thoughts, and so it's only in the present moment that it's possible to access your true nature, the higher self that resides within you, and then it's very difficult to be present when your mind is in a constant chatter. Your mind will do everything it can to keep you out of the present moment, because the present moment is death to the mind. But in the moment and in an integrated state, the two go hand in hand to really put you presently in the present moment. You learn to create this gap between your thoughts. And it's only in this gap that the presence of your true nature is allowed to come through. And it's not something you can prove. You can only live it. You can only experience it. But as you do, then, for me, it's gotten to the point to where this book, it just wrote itself. I was just going along for the ride, man. You know, it's like, But 25 years ago, when I first started out writing, it was the most difficult task ever until I finally learned to trust and let go and allow it to start to come through me. And then, and only then, did it finally become a book. So I'm a little further down that pathway than I was back then.
Beautiful. In the book you write, I love this, these passages you wrote. I was finally waking up to my true purpose, what I was really here for, to be an interdimensional master co-creating heaven on earth. So are you. It's just my job to remind you. I wonder what comes up for you when I read those words, beautiful words.
Well, it's just the way it is. I mean, there's nothing unique or special about any one of us. Everyone has the same capacity, and it all resides within them. But we live in a culture because we are so mind-based and so polarized, where we have been so conditioned that the power and the authority lies outside of ourselves. So many people have given their power away to the nth degree, and in so doing become helpless victims. What's left at that point is no understanding of your creative capabilities, and you're totally at the mercy of others coming to try and help you. Now what was the question? Because I
just read that quote, and I just asked what came up for you, if you could expand on that and
how. Yeah. Yeah, so it's learning to go within, and everybody has the same internal capabilities. Everybody has a higher self, their connection to source. Source energy is real. It's just kind of like at the very peak of the cosmic pyramid, if you will, where the energy is so pure and so powerful. I mean, you can call it God and all that stuff. I don't get hung up on names. I like to call it source energy, really. But it's real stuff. And it really, the reason breathwork is so powerful is because I teach people how to access it through the breath. Because when you learn how to breathe in what I call a circular breathing rhythm, what you're doing is taking in vast amounts of prana, which is life force energy, which is source energy. We cannot exist without it. And so, yes, we do take in prana, but at infinitesimally small amounts until you learn how to take it in. And in so doing, you facilitate an internal house cleaning process that opens you up, that gets rid of some of the gunk. You know, if you live in a house that you haven't cleaned for 20 years, there's just going to be a lot of extraneous junk that once you get rid of it, you're going to have a little more space and a little more freedom to move about. Well, the same is true within each and every one of us. And so once you integrate some of that internal gunk, now you're creating enough space to be able to create a gap between your thoughts so source energy can come through you, and you're running enormous amounts of source energy through you every time you're doing a session anyway. And so, connecting to source, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're spiritual beings. You are, I am. There's no exception to that on this planet. Never has been, never will be. No matter how much you want to pretend that you're not, you still are. So,
it's funny that you mentioned God and source energy, because my very next question was going to concern God. Because elsewhere in the book, you write in a similar vein to the quote I just said, as my doubts melted away, I was left with the full presence of my true purpose as a higher dimensional master here to co-create heaven on earth. I say this only to serve as a reminder to you of how great you are. The spirit of God is in every one of us. Just look in another's eyes. The time to remember this is now. Such a beautiful passage near the end of the book. And I was going to ask if what comes up for you when I read that, and also how do you personally conceive of God? How would you put into words that which cannot ultimately be said?
Well, I just gave what I would consider to be my answer to that, that it's source energy. Mm. You perhaps, if you want to, you could look at it as kind of like the absolute peak of the cosmic pyramid. Mm-hmm. I mean, here again, all the different dimensional realities. And as you move up the dimensional levels, fourth dimension, if a fourth dimensional being were to appear here, that body would be pure light. He or she would be able to walk through, we would see a light being capable of walking through walls and whatever. So as you move up, the vibratory rate dramatically increases. It becomes very increasingly obvious that everything is just light. Everything is just energy. It's not really dense and solid like it appears here. It's only because the vibratory rate is so very slow. But you keep going up the dimensional levels, and you don't have to get very high up, fifth, sixth dimension at the most, where you don't even need a form anymore. You're just pure energy. You're just, if anything, just a pure ball of light, totally aware, totally aware of all the, you know, that's above you and below you, and clearly living and knowing with certainty the oneness, no matter what level you're on. And you can imagine that, how much higher can you go? Well, if you just keep going up and up and up, at a certain point, you could get to what you might call the very peak of the cosmic pyramid. And that's this source energy in its purest, in its most powerful form. And so it comes down. And as it goes through, down through the dimensional levels, it gets veiled more and more. And by the time it reaches the third dimensional level, the level that we're on, it is so veiled that most people have taken it and turned it into a belief system. We call it religion, which, oh, I believe, you know, well, good for you. What good is it doing you? You know, so it's not, as a belief system, it's not worth much. But if you can learn to live it, now you're getting somewhere. And so you only learn to live it by learning to connect within, by learning to go within.
And would you say that source energy is ultimately the only thing that exists in an absolute sense?
Well, everything is source energy. It's only a question of what form it is in. Mm-hmm. There's only one creation pattern throughout all of the cosmos, throughout all the dimensional levels, only one image, only one spirit moving throughout all of life. I don't know if I put that in the original version, but in the new book, I make the case of how there, in fact, was a time before any of these different waveform dimensional universes were created. And all there was just pure source energy in perfect awareness of the fact that it is source energy. But, or you can call it God or whatever the heck you want. But at a certain point, you know, life is a game. And so why not create all these different waveform universes and with a virtually infinite number of possibilities? Each waveform universe is completely different. And so it opens up a whole new experiential possibility depending on what dimensional level you're on. So, I mean, it gives the eternal spirit an opportunity to play around and to see what, you know, what all these possibilities might be like and all that. Mm. And so I go on to say that Source or God or whoever you want to call it, split him herself into two. Part of him, her, stayed on the other side and remained pure source without, and the other half of him, her, came into to live and experience directly all these different waveform universes. However, if it's waveform, if it vibrates, it's an illusion. It's not real. The only thing that's really real is what's on the other side. And there ain't no, It's just everything, nothing, out of which everything comes. Everything and nothing comes, including every vibratory rate, every waveform universe. But anything that vibrates is just an illusion. And that's some more stuff I got in this one.
In the new version.
You ain't going to find it in that one.
Okay, yeah, I need to get the new version.
Yeah.
I've come to conceive of it as a divine game of hide and seek, a divine game of forgetting and remembering.
Yeah.
All that is chooses to forget itself in infinite particular forms to explore its infinite potentialities. And we're all, the motion of the Tao is remembering. We're all in this process of remembering who we truly are, remembering our true nature. And as you connect to that, you do realize that your fundamental nature is the infinite power that birthed infinite creation. And that's one of the most empowering realizations I've ever had.
Yeah, I first heard that way, way back in the day from a book by Alan Watts called The Book. Great book.
I've read that
and
book.
So he, yeah. Oh, great, you did one. Too. Yeah, so yeah. He tells the story of the game of hide and seek, and it's so good. It's just like you said. It's just like you said, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
I love Alan. Peace to his soul, wherever he is right now.
Yeah, right. Well, that was my first eye-opener. I mean, it was way back in 1972 when, you know, I realized that, you know, I better learn to heal my back, and I still wasn't totally crippled. I could still bowl as long as I didn't, you know, sort of. And I was still in my quest to be the very best that I could be. And so I had a friend who understood exactly. And he said, well, what you need to do is you need to get hold of this book. To this day, I don't understand why he suggested the book by Alan Watts to improve my bowling game, but I'm really glad he did. Because when I got that book, I could not put it down. It just resonated very, very deeply, and it just began the whole journey. So, yeah, good old Alan Watts. Wow.
A fascinating parallel is, have you ever heard of the somewhat joke religion Dudism?
No.
Have you ever seen The Big Lebowski? Do you know about the dude, the character in The Big Lebowski, who's a bowler?
Yeah, I've heard of it from other people, but I haven't. Okay. I've never seen The Big Lebowski, whoever the heck he is.
I gotcha. He's basically like a modern kind of Taoist figure, a very go with the flow figure who is a bowler. And there's this, someone created a religion or a philosophy that's somewhat of a parody religion, but also has a lot of, it's basically a modern formulation of Taoism called Dudism, based on the dude from The Big Lebowski. And their famous icon is a yin and yang symbol, but with three dots in each side as if it was a bowling ball. So maybe, maybe the book by Alan Watts, I know he discusses the yin and yang, I think, in that book, but interestingly, that just seems like an interesting parallel there somehow. But yeah, that's funny.
Okay, the Big Lebowski. Well, maybe someday, you know.
I wanted to ask you as well about, you mentioned Drunvalo already, and I wanted to mention that Drunvalo Melchizedek, I think, is that how you say is the last name?
It's close enough.
Is my understanding is he's one of your greatest influences, and he influenced a lot of the teaching in the original Nothing in This Book Is True. And I wondered how you came upon Drunvalo's work and what led you to be so captivated by it initially.
Yeah, well, back in the day, he was very influential in that what he did was he showed me the unity of life, the unity of being. And so that was very important and very necessary. What my meeting him came out of was my burning desire to keep going, that I knew there was missing information. I got to that point in about 1990, knew that there was missing information that I needed to be aware of. And I had absolutely no idea what it was, where to look, how to find it. But I knew none of that mattered because I knew I had the entrance requirement. And that was the total burning desire to find out. And so in June of 1992, I met Drunvalo on video, where I was taking part in a video workshop with about 20, 25 other people. We were just watching the videos of one of his workshops. And I realized maybe about 5 minutes into the presentation that this is exactly where I needed to be and exactly what I needed to be hearing. And I realized instantly that not only that, but I also got the instant realization that I wanted to know what he knows, so that I wanted to master his work. And I had made a similar decision 4 years earlier with a man by the name of Jim Leonard, who taught me a version of breathwork that so far surpassed what I was learning from Leonard or anybody else, that it's really what led to my healing. And I made the decision with Jim Leonard, I want to know what this guy knows. And when you bring a total burning desire into it, you get to know what this guy knows real quick. And so I've done that not only with Jim Leonard, but also with Drunvalo. And mm-hmm. those were two of the most empowering decisions that I've ever made. They both completely transformed my life. To this moment, my interaction and learning from Jim Leonard, I would say, is more significant and more important, because that was directly with breathwork, than what I learned from Drunvalo. But I don't want to dismiss what I learned from Drunvalo, because at the time it is exactly what I needed to know to just keep me moving. without really getting the unity of being, you can only go so far. Your mind will stop you beyond a certain point because it doesn't believe, you know. So, his teaching was very, very instrumental, very important for me.
And you ended up meeting Trun Valo.
We became good friends. Yeah. And communicating on the telephone regularly. And he trained me in person to teach his workshop, I started teaching in 1995 and continued teaching it through 2016. So what is that, 21 years? I still do the workshop, but what I did is I put it on video and I sell it as an online video course right now. Hmm. It's called The Flower of Life Workshop, Igniting Your Inner Light is the subtitle I've given for it.
And what's your website where people could find that?
Oh, it's bobfrizzell.com.
Bobfrizzell.com.
Yeah.
And what was it like to meet Trun Valo in person and be in his physical presence? I'm curious about what his energy field was like.
Well, he's very light and easygoing and fun to be with and very knowledgeable. And so he was very likable. Didn't have this "I'm better than you are" act or any of that stuff going on. He seemed to be quite, if not totally, non-judgmental. And just present. And so, you know, I just picked up on all of that and began to quickly realize it's because he's living unity and this is exactly what I wanted to learn from him. And here again, because I had the total burning desire, this is exactly what happened. Hmm. So, it was good. In many ways, he was the purest event energy of any of the many, many, and I've hung out with a lot of different teachers, but his energy was very pure, very good. Yeah.
Beautiful. We've talked a couple times in this conversation about psychedelics and plant medicines. Our audience is particularly interested in this subject. I was curious if you yourself have worked with psychedelics or plant medicines and if they played any kind of important role on your path.
Yeah. Well, I have, but not last psychedelic, I think, trip I had was maybe about 30 years ago or so. But I did a number of LSD trips, mushrooms. I think mushrooms and ecstasy were my two favorites. The first experience on mushrooms was incredible, no doubt about it. And the same is true for ecstasy, as long as you can get good, pure stuff. I would still take ecstasy today if I knew it was pure and good. I probably wouldn't say no to mushrooms either if you pass them by me. I don't know about LSD. Like I said, it's a door opener. But, you know, you're not going to stay up on that stuff all the time. You are going to come down. But you've been shown a possibility. And like I say, now the job is to learn how to get there without the enhancement of the psychedelic. Mm-hmm. And that's a fun game.
It is a fun game. We've talked as well about the planetary transformation we're going through, the major planetary shift to some kind of higher level of consciousness. I wondered if you could say a bit more about the nature of this shift or summarize what you believe or you see as the nature of the shift?
Well, there's so much that could be said about it. In the book, I give the details of how it was the Ascended Masters who made it all possible by creating the vehicle, if you will, that will allow us and the planet to ascend into the next level. That without that vehicle, it's called grid, without that vehicle, there would be no possibility. There would be no way. So there's all of that aspect to it. And that's why they constructed the Great Pyramid along with 83,000 sacred sites to make that whole thing possible. But what it also does is, again, without that vehicle, without that grid, there would not be an acceleration of the vibratory rate on the planet. The energy would not be quickening. So the two do go hand in hand. And I just can't, in the time we have, cannot get into the details of the creation of the grid above the Earth. But it is what's allowing everything to come forth. here again, though, on an individual level, as your vibratory rate begins to increase, you begin to move out of stuckness, out of being stuck and limited by your fears and by all the unresolved emotional trauma that really everybody has. I mean, we all were mismanaged as children. There's no exception to that. Some of us got a bigger dose of it than others. Some people really got a whammy, you know, through emotional and physical abuse that really sticks with you until you learn to heal it, till you learn to integrate it. The most common expression is the healing of the inner child. Well, that's what I'm talking about here. But until you learn to deal and to integrate and to heal that stuff, there is just a very limit. You know, you can only go so far, and it's not very far. You're going to be stopped by your own stuff until you learn, and there's only one way. You have to learn to integrate that to heal it. You don't Band-Aid it over, or don't pretend it's not. And most people do. It doesn't work very well. But as you do, your vibratory rate naturally begins to quicken. So you're not stuck in fear and doubt and hatred and anxiety and stuff like that. And as your vibratory level quickens, you begin to realize that, hey, life is really pretty good. And there's a lot of stuff out there to be grateful for. And so that's a much, much higher vibratory rate than fears and doubts and unresolved emotions. And so once the vibratory rate quickens, a whole new world begins to open up to you. And books automatically begin to appear in some obscure used bookstore like they did to you. And, you know, that, you know, you wouldn't have been ready for it before you were ready. So it's like that, you know.
How does the Merkaba energy field tie in with this discussion of shifting to a higher level of consciousness or higher dimensional level on Earth?
Well, according to Drunvalo, it's the universal pattern of creation. It's the image through which all things within waveform universe were created. So to go back to the story of how before any of the waveform universe was created and all there was the eternal oneness, and God split him, herself into two. Half of him, her, came to this side to experience it directly. Well, the vehicle was the Merkaba, a living energy field around the particular vehicle that the entity assumed, whether it was a physical body or just, you know, a ball of light or whatever, that would enable you to change your conscious wavelength. And in this case, to move out of nothingness, everything nothingness, into the illusory vibratory thing that we call, you know, dimensional worlds. And to return to the other side whenever you're ready to. So it is the image through which all things within waveform universe were created, at least allegedly. And that image is around your body. And once you know, everything is a function of consciousness. You're never going to discover it when you're stuck in your fears and limitations and unresolved emotional trauma. But once you learn to integrate that and increase your vibratory rate, then this stuff becomes a bit more real for you. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the Merkaba is a vehicle of ascension. And at the appropriate moment, I give all the details of how that at some point, who knows when, could be tomorrow, it could be 100 years from now, I don't know. But at some point, this planet will reach critical mass and the ascension into the fourth dimension will occur. And so the common way that an individual uses to travel from one dimensional world to another through the vehicle of ascension is turning your body into a ball of light, changing your conscious wavelength, and in that way, reappearing in whatever world you've tuned to. Well, that's another way of talking about the Merkaba, really.
Hmm. Beautiful.
So you know, in the life and teaching of the masters, they don't use the word Merkaba. I think Merkaba is referenced in the Bible. Not sure. But again, I'm not a student of the Bible, but I think it is. It doesn't matter what you call it. It's that the fact that, you know, if you can believe what you're reading in the life and teaching of the masters, these guys have the ability to ascend into the higher worlds, taking their body with them, to come back and to grab a body anytime they want. And they evidently do it on a regular basis. That's how it's done. So it's a bit more advanced than where you and I are at, but hey, you know.
Maybe someday.
Yeah.
You also write about this transformation. The second coming of Christ is not the second coming of man. Rather, it is an emanation of the luminescence within all beings who are ready. The beings on this planet are becoming illuminated from within, and they are beginning to rely more on their own internal authority.
Yeah, that's the whole creation of the critical mass thing. Right, right. So there isn't any savior. Nobody's going to come along to save us. I mean, you know, a lot of people ask, well, why don't the ETs save us? I mean, for God's sakes, man, I'll tell you why they won't save us. And that's because until you learn how to do it for yourself, even if they did save us, what good would it do? You'd be doomed to repeat your mistakes over and over and over until you figure it out for yourself. I mean, so this whole thing is just a school. It's about, you know, shedding what's not real and learning what is real. And, you know, so ain't nobody gonna come along to save us. No, come on.
We need to remember it's that we
us.
Are it. Yeah,
that's
we
right. Are it. That's right.
Yeah. So I have just a couple questions left here, but I wanted to read one longer and particularly rich passage from your book, if that's okay, and ask a couple questions about it. You wrote, "On our level of existence, we interpret things differently. We think we see good and evil. What is really going on, however, is timing. The forces of polarity are necessary for the proper functioning of the universe. Remember, the dark forces do everything they can to hinder a particular area of consciousness, be it on a planetary or individual scale. The light forces do everything they can to encourage consciousness expansion and awareness. This opposition causes consciousness to move upward at exactly the right pace. In the birth of a child, for example, 9 months is the proper time, not 3 months or 15 months. The forces of polarity cause the child to be born at exactly the right time. So given where we are, we need to see good and evil and be aware of them, but we also need to recognize that the presence of God is in every situation and that there is a reason for everything that happens. We need to see that everything is whole and complete and perfect and that there is nothing wrong, no matter how bad or how good it may seem. We need to see that life engenders a deep conscious aspect that is everywhere. In our state, we tend to think that we live inside this body, that everything, quote, out there is separate from us, and that our feelings and thoughts don't manifest beyond ourselves. We think that we can hide our thoughts and feelings, and they have no impact, quote, out there. This is simply not true. Everything that we think, feel, and do is creating our whole world all the way out to the most distant stars. We are creating everything in every moment, more so than we could ever imagine." So that was a mouthful, but I found that to be a particularly luminous and wonderful passage, and there's a lot we could talk about in there. I wondered if you could say something about what you said about polarity and duality, and say something about how the polarity and duality that characterizes this world of form and appearances melts away in states of unity consciousness and as you tap more into source energy.
Sure. What we need to realize is that the mind is polarized, and you and I have become our mind. We are our minds. In the new book, I give all the details about how the purpose of the mind is the survival. Really, what the mind is a very sophisticated multisensory recording device that is recording successive moments of now. And the purpose of the mind is the survival of the being, or whatever the being considers itself to be. Now, when the being considers itself to be the mind, the purpose of the mind now becomes the survival of the mind itself. All the thoughts and the beliefs and all the clutter that, you know, the beliefs that keep us one step removed from reality, keep us living life conceptually rather than living life as a living experience. And so the polarized mind, because of its total state of survival, has very much a need to be right. And so we see good and evil. This is good, this is evil. This is right, this is wrong. But that's only a function of our polarized consciousness. That's only mind-based reality. From a larger perspective, once we step out of polarization, out of mind-based reality, and into unity, the same thing, the same exact event is going to show up very differently. Because you see what seems to be these two opposing forces, opposed to each other in every conceivable way. One doing everything it can to stop you, the other doing everything it can to advance you. they're really just two differing aspects of the same thing. And they, in fact, are working together in harmony. And that timing is everything. So it's only a function of polarity consciousness that we see that good is good and it must win, and evil is evil and it must be defeated. I mean, that's the perfect prescription for destroying your planet and not getting along with one another. So that whole thing is hopefully living out its final days. So that's at least a partial answer that I would give.
Yeah, beautiful. One related anecdote that I really love that I came upon recently from Jed McKenna. I don't know if you've ever heard of Jed McKenna's books, Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing, as a trilogy. He talks about how the yin and yang symbol can be viewed almost like a matrix. And inside the circle is the world of duality and polarity, where we see right and wrong and good and evil. And that's where most of us are on the level of mind and the level of the five senses, the world of form. We're trapped within that. And outside the circle is where it all, you see that it all melts into the same unity, and you see that it's all emanating from the same source, and that it's all actually part of this perfection. So I liked that metaphor, I guess, for the journey of consciousness expansion. And I was also going to, did you have something to add to that?
Oh, there's so much. I mean, we could spend 3 or 4 hours talking about that, but you know.
Yeah.
But maybe we can just leave it as it is for the moment.
Sure.
I go into a lot more detail of all this in the book.
In that long passage I read, you also talk about the realization that everything is perfect, whole, complete, and it's been in mystical states that I've been in, most notably working with ayahuasca, where I've also experienced this overwhelming remembrance that all is God and that all is perfect, whole, complete in every moment, and nothing can ever be wrong. And this realization has changed my entire life and allowed me to go deeper into a level of trust that's opened up a whole new way of flowing through reality. And I'm curious, what was your journey, or what was, when did you start to realize this, and how did it change your life, and what does it feel like to begin trusting spirit and trusting the great mystery at all times?
Well, starting from square one, out of the absolute need to find a way to heal myself, that was the door opener. And again, fueled only by the total burning desire to do whatever was necessary, to do whatever it took. And so it didn't take too long to begin to realize that everything is a function of consciousness. And if you want to learn to heal yourself, that's exactly how you learn to heal yourself. Everything is a function of consciousness. And so that just led to everything else. Here again, if you want to know badly enough, I mean, for me, my life experience has been that the door is just open. And it's like people come out of the crawl out of the woodwork to give me exactly what I need in the moment. Now, I may never see that person again, and only for a brief 5-minute encounter. But in that 5-minute encounter, that person gave me exactly what I needed. Well, that person ain't going to crawl out of the woodwork unless you're burning with the fire of purpose. But if you are, things happen that otherwise just never, ever possibly could have occurred. So that's been the story of my life ever since 1976, really.
Beautiful. And also in that long passage, you note that we're creating our realities in every moment more than we could ever imagine. Could you say something more about the dynamics of how we create and choose our realities in each moment, and how this revelation changed your life?
Yeah, but do you have 5 or 6 hours to get into that?
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I
get the book, guys. That's what the 10 new chapters are all about. Yeah, and I give the exact details on just what I mean when I say that you and I are creating the reality all the way out to the most distant stars. It's literally true, by the way. But I could tell you that everything you see out there is nothing but an illusion, that in fact it's just a holographic projection of your consciousness. But if you didn't think I was nuts, you'd probably be quite convinced at this point. So, I mean, you can't, it's just kind of like hard to drop a soundbite and just leave it at that. That's why it took a whole new book to really give the details on that. But I'm probably my own worst critic, yet I'm very, very pleased with how this new book turned out. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't, you know, if I could rewrite it today, I don't think I would change a thing. So mm-hmm. it says what I wanted to say, and I do give a detailed answer to your questions in that book. So you're going to get your mind blown when you read that book, I tell you, Jordan. If you thought the old version did it, well, you just wait.
I'm looking forward to that. So wrapping up here, I wonder if you have any aphorisms or heuristics that you think are particularly useful for individuals when it comes to navigating life in general or life at this particular moment in history?
Well, I would just say that we live in extremely exciting times. I mean, it's just, I just feel so grateful to be alive and to be able to participate in this and to be able to have lifted enough of the veil so that I'm not sucked in by what appears to be what's happening. What you think is happening for the average Joe out there, come on, that's got little, if anything at all, to do with what's really going on. So, I mean, it's just fun to be able to watch the show and not get sucked in by it. Helen Keller said it best, you know, she couldn't see, blind and deaf and holy cow, you've heard of Helen Keller, right?
Yes.
Yeah, everybody's heard of Helen Keller. Well, she said life is either an exciting adventure or it's nothing.
Mm.
And so that is so well said, it's just totally a function of consciousness. And if you want to wake up and come along for the ride, it's an exciting adventure. And I'm just inviting people to participate because, you know, I'm kind of like interested in creating this critical mass. Come on, guys.
There you go. And the gateless gate is wide open for those who want to leap into a different one.
And it's fun. Come on along.
It is fun. Damn, is it fun.
Jump in. The water's good.
So last question here. If someone were to ask you to share the greatest secret of the universe that you're aware of, what would you say?
Come on. let's leave it with the last question.
okay, fair enough. Won't reveal. Have to wait for the next episode or the next book for the most secret mysteries. All right, well, Bob, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for coming on the podcast, and yeah, really enjoyed this conversation and meeting you. Take care, my friend.
Well, read the new book and we'll do it again.
Okay, that sounds good, brother.
Yeah,
okay. Take it easy.
Well, it's been fun. So I've enjoyed spending the time with you, and I really hope that our conversation has been useful and helpful, or at least entertaining. I mean, you know, come on, lighten up, folks. We're just having fun.
I think it has been. I think it has been.
Yeah, well, it's been fun. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the High Existence Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, of course, leaving a review, sharing it with your friends, leaving a comment, sending an email, anything, just letting us know that you liked it, giving feedback, any kind of support from you is always appreciated. Thank you so much. Can't wait to keep doing these and getting more amazing guests for you to listen to and enjoy. So thank you and farewell.